right, folks, everybody, welcome to the second of the two conference calls that we're doing on the plant propagation course. I want to let you guys know we do have some questions that came in by email, but we're going to give priority to you guys who are here with us on a Sunday afternoon. If you're just coming on the line now, everybody's phone is muted, so you know you don't have to really worry about background noise until we call on you. We'll start taking questions in just a minute. The way that you let us know you have a question is hit 5-star on your phone. That'll raise your electronic hand, and we can call on you one at a time. That keeps everything nice and quiet during the presentation so that there's no dogs barking or kids screaming in the background or whatever. And when I call on you, what I'm going to be doing is saying we have a question from, let's say, area code 573. You'll know it's probably you. And just at that point, speak up and give us your question. Primarily, I'm going to take the questions. This is Jack, of course, on the business stuff, and Nick will primarily take it on the plant stuff. But if it goes the way it did yesterday, we'll both have ideas on both sides of it. And we're now open for questions. So I see we already have somebody with a question. And hold just a second for me. Okay, caller from area code 720, your line is now open for your question.
Hi, I was wondering what things don't you want to do, like in the greenhouse during winter to get ready for spring and summer? Some things you just don't really like being messed with in the winter that might possibly mess up their clock or however you want to put it.
So, this is to be clear, are you talking about other certain plants that, like, during the overwintering process, you just be completely left alone? Is that what you're basically asking?
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. So any kind of stone fruits really shouldn't be in a greenhouse anyways. Anything that you're growing in the greenhouse is because you need it to not get cold.
And not go dormant.
So there are a lot of things that need a certain period of dormancy, like stone fruits, apples, a lot of the normal types of fruits, apples, peaches, pears, plums, cherries, you know, things like that. Those all need a certain amount of cold hours. It's the cold chill hours. So anything like that should be outside anyways.
And I would add to it this. If it's a perennial that goes dormant, I would prefer that it go dormant whether it needs to or not, because I don't have to really take care of it very much during the winter. So if you take something that normally would go dormant, put it in your greenhouse and keep it not dormant, you get the extra growth maybe. I don't know how much growth you're going to really get on some of them, because they have this internal clock that wants to go to sleep. But then you've now basically turned something that was really hardy and would take care of itself and doesn't need you into a baby that has to be looked after every day. So to me, if I had a whole bunch of perennials that were going to go dormant and I could just water them and set them underneath like a tent somewhere or something, like a plastic that's going to let them be cold, and I don't have to touch them for 4 months until spring, I'd prefer to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to turn you off. At least try to, if the system will let us. I am now going to call on area code 832. Your line will be open in just a second. Okay, area code 832, we should be able to hear from you now.
Yes, good morning. This is Randy from Houston. Thank you for doing these conference calls. I think they're fantastic. My question is,
go ahead.
You guys went through the effort. Yes, Randy from Houston speaking here. When you guys went through the effort to decide what content to put into the course, what are some of the key principles you wanted to make sure the students walked away with?
Well, the basic idea with the Permeathos Basic Plant Propagation course was I wanted to provide the ground level foundational information so that anyone with any level of experience with growing plants, starting plants, gardening, anything like that, could start seeds, know what to look for in basic, you know, diseases, you know, the most common diseases, the easiest to deal with, I wanted to show you a couple methods of grafting, and a couple other methods of propagation, you know, division. I wanted to open up everyone's minds to the concepts and the ideas, and then show some of the basic how-to. But I wanted to keep it simple enough that I wouldn't make it too complicated and overwhelming for someone who was an absolute novice and beginner.
And I think the big thing we want is that you guys feel, after taking this course, I can propagate plants of most varieties. There might be some really specialized things. There might be some specialized grafting techniques and things like that that we would cover in a more advanced class. But so that students could, if they wanted to, legitimately now begin to produce enough plants to produce an income for yourself. And so that was kind of my challenge to Nick. That's what I wanted done. I think he did a good job with it. But those were the concepts that were all the things that make producing plants easy to do. I'll pause just for a second here to say I hear a lot of guys coming on the line right now. So if you're coming on the line, you didn't hear the intro. If you have a question, you hit 5-star. We'll call on you in order. So again, to ask a question, 5-star. But that anyway, back to what I was saying. That was my goal, is to make sure that you guys would be able to say, okay, here's 4 or 5 methods of production. I can grab onto 1 or 2, pick the stuff I want to lead off my initiative with, and start producing them as an income source, or to be able to look at your own property and say to yourself, you know what? To plant this property the way that I would really want to, if I had a blue sky budget, I'd be buying $30,000 worth of plants and be able to look at it and say, you know what? Now I can produce them for $2,000 for myself. And to be able to give the ROI that way. So in either or proposition, my real hope for a lot of you guys is you'll see kind of the big long-term vision and do a little bit of a hybrid of both. So for instance, on my property, I'm putting in some really high value plants that are not just so they'll be here and produce for me, but they'll produce material for me so that I can produce them in my nursery. And that's, I think, really valuable, especially if you're going to develop local markets, because when somebody comes to your house and you are selling them a little goji bush in a little half-gallon container that's a few inches tall and just starting to put leaves on, and they say, what does it look like? And you can point to a hedgerow of them covered in berries or covered in flowers, and they can see it. I think that actually adds a lot more than a picture in a catalog, if that makes sense. Is there anything we're missing with your question?
No, that was very well answered. The follow-up I would ask is, did you have in your mind a measure for the success of your students when you launched this?
Are you happy, I guess, would be, I mean, our biggest measure. If you feel that you got your money's worth, your value out of the course, and you feel that you're ready to take the information and put it to work, and for those that want to go to a more advanced level, do you feel like you'd want to go to that next level? Those would be, you know, my two basic layers. The true success would be when somebody emails me and goes, Jack, Nick, I just sold $5,000 worth of plants. I mean, I'm going to have a party the day I get that email.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I want. I want as many. I don't want anybody that's thinking, you know what, I just took this course to make plants for my property. Great. I'm glad. But I want, if you want to go further, I want to know that you now have the knowledge available to you, even if you haven't mastered it, even if you have to go through the course 5 or 6 times. And I think that's something that a lot of you guys might want to do is, you know, process all the things you think you want to do and then go back and take the course completely through again. You know, it's 6 hours or something like that. Because when you deal with a person like Nick, he's saying little things throughout the whole thing that are really important, but you're grabbing, you know, the top 10% for you. And the second time, you're going to grab different information. But again, can you be profitable, or can you produce what you want for your own property? Are you happy? And for those that want to go to the next level, do you feel ready now to go to another layer, another level of propagation? That's what I wanted.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to – and those of you, once I've called on you, if you have another question, you can hit 5-star to re-raise your hand. I'm trying to go in order on the list, though, so that we get to people in a row. Next person on the list that I have is area code 913. You should hear your line open in just a second. Area code 913. And 913, you should now
yes.
open. Go ahead.
I'm in Kansas,
Okay.
And my question is, as far as when you from a nursery, say, is there a liability as far as propagating from that particular plant? I know I've seen, and I don't know what species or what plant it was, but I know I've seen, you know, some statement that, you know, this cannot be propagated or something like that. Is that a standard thing, or is there, does it have to be stated?
Yeah. Okay. So the basic thing is you need to know, is this plant patented? If it is, you are not, and I'm air quoting here, allowed to duplicate this plant. I will not ever recommend that you duplicate plants that are patented. But I'm not going to know, so if you do, don't tell me. If you do and you sell it,
you got a problem.
You could be in big trouble. Trademarked plants, as long as you don't use the trademark name, you can do all the propagation you want with it, and you can sell it, and no one will care. But you just can't use that name. Jack, I know...
Yeah, let me explain kind of what we mean by that. So there is a variety of goji berry out there called Phoenix Tears. Phoenix Tears was a goji found in the Utah desert. There's no way to patent it. But the owner found it, did some research on it, found the history of it, put a name on it.
And a story.
And a story on it. He sells it on that story of Phoenix Tears. And if you came upon stock from his root, there'd be no way to know because there's nothing genetically unique about it. It wasn't made from a cross. It wasn't done through a bunch of laboratory work or anything like that. There's no right to patent that because it's basically a wild cultivar. But he's put his name on it. So I think he charges to use his name $2 a plant. And since he's small, you might actually be able to sell under his trademark. He might deal with you. A lot of bigger nurseries with trademarks, Stark Brothers or whatever, or even with patents, unless you're selling 1,000 plants, they don't want to deal with you, right? So if it's patented, I just, you know, I'll put it this way. Sometimes plants replicate themselves on your own property and there's nothing you can do about it. But I would not try to sell a patented variety. And I would never sell a trademark variety and even hint to knowing its trademark name. You find the underlying product. So, for instance, there's people that would take something like a Red Delicious apple and then put 100 of them in and then pick the tree that was producing the best one. And then, you know, grow their own special rootstock for it and put that on there and call it the Jack Spirko Red Delicious Apple, which will never exist, by the way. And then I've trademarked that name under a well-known apple, but I put my trademark on it. You can go nuts with that. But patented, leave it alone, unless you're getting to a point where you're going to sell 1,000 plants. And then usually it's not much. It's like a dollar, right? So Dave Wilson has a lot of patented plants, really cool stuff, apricot, plum hybrids and stuff like that. But he won't even give you the permission to use his patent if you're making 50 trees. He doesn't want to deal with that. So unless you actually get up to some level of small commercial production, the patented stuff, most of those guys aren't going to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So if I went to, say, a neighbor's property that said, yeah, I don't care, you can take cuttings from that tree. I don't know that tree. He planted it, you know, 15
yeah.
years ago. He doesn't know where the tree came from. I mean, that wouldn't be a problem, correct?
What's the patent length? I don't even know. Is it 30 years or 20 years?
I don't know.
There's a patent. See, all these patents have a length of time that the law is willing to protect them under.
Right. For instance, Pink Lady apples have just their patent just recently expired.
So they've become an open variety.
So now it's an open variety. You can take Pink Lady cuttings off of a Pink Lady apple tree, graft those onto whatever apple stock you want to, and now you have Pink Lady apples that you can actually sell as Pink Lady.
But her point is she doesn't know where this tree came from.
Right.
So the way you could do that is if it's like an apple, there's probably someone that could identify for you what it is. Most common fruits, you'll be able to sort of kind of figure out. Most trees that originally come from box stores tend to be open varieties because it's just they go in that mass production model. It's usually especially nurseries that have the more patented varieties. Mm-hmm. But if you want, it doesn't matter. Let's put it this way. It doesn't matter where the material comes from. Your first duty is to identify the plant so that you know what you're selling, right? Once you do, you can go to Google and Google will tell you if it's patented or not. And if you can't,
okay, that makes a lot of sense.
If you can't tell, but you have no reason to believe it's a patented variety, what's your first name?
Marie.
Marie, it could always become Marie's apple. We just named one recently. We have an apricot growing on my property that Nick took cuttings from yesterday. We know it's not a patented variety. We don't know what it is, but we decided to call it Plano Man apricot.
Yeah.
So we can do that, you know, for the rest of our lives if we want to. Somebody else can too, because I'm not going to trademark it. But you can, as long as you know it's probably not patented. You know, it's just your apple. I'm going to go ahead and take another call now. And again, those that are coming on, I hear people coming on left and right. So 5-star. Is the way to raise your hand. I'm now going to call on area code 989. 989, you should be open.
Yeah, Nick, can you take a moment and talk about how you...
Can you restate that? We lost you there.
Okay, Nick, could you take a moment and talk about how you would set up a grow room, just a simple one with like a, you know, a 4-foot light? What things you would take into consideration when doing that?
Sure. So you're talking about indoors, like in your house?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So one of the things that you're going to want to make sure is you've got adequate light. So depending on the wattage of the system you're using, I really like the lights that I have in the resources. In the tools section, I have the... Now I can't remember the brand name, but I have the brand name on there, and I have the 4-foot, 8-bulb, T5 grow lights. And they're like $180 or so, but you get great, great light coverage, and I get really good dense growth. So I would make sure, A, I have good light, because that is your number one problem when growing indoors, is people underestimate how much light you need. Second would be make sure you have airflow. So if you're in a room like a closet and the air is really still and nothing is moving, then you should put a fan in there. Don't put the fan where it's blowing directly on your plants, because that's going to dry them out too quick. But you want to blow on the ground or on the ceiling or on the wall, so that it's moving the air in that room, and occasionally vent it out, because you don't want really high humidity, because then you're going to have fungal problems. So, you know, good light, air movement, and, you know, make sure that you can get water to it easily. If you spill, you're not going to ruin something. I wouldn't put that in a room that was really small. You know, the bigger volume of air you have in there, the less humidity issues you're going to have. And, you know, if you have drywall and you have really humid air in there, you're going to start having mold issues in your drywall. So those are the big things.
Would you do anything specific for, like, reflecting the light?
Most of those lights have really good reflectors on them. So, no, I wouldn't worry about it.
If you want to Mac it out, get in touch with Evan Folds.
Yeah,
over at Progressive Gardens, and he will Mac you out. I think he's based in, or he's selling a lot to Colorado, so he has a lot of experience with indoor growing.
Right. If you look online for indoor growing stuff, a lot of hydroponic stuff, there are some people that grow things indoors very covertly. I don't recommend doing that, but the same technologies that work for that kind of growing work for growing tomatoes.
Absolutely. Or microgreens, which are...
Or microgreens, you know, whatever.
Almost as much as the stuff you can't grow.
Right.
Don't do that. Did you see the drug dealer that got busted because the snow melted on his roof?
Oh, my gosh.
So it was like this row house. Instead of row houses, in one house had all the snow melted off. So they'll do that. But any other questions on that?
No, thank you very much for that. Just one other question. You guys have talked about an advanced course. You know when that one's coming up?
Nope, don't know yet. I'm going to be working on that this year. It might come out this year.
I'd bet next early, like this time next year is my guess. Nick's about to have a baby. That's going to be difficult for you to do, but you're going to do it somehow.
Yeah, I'm about to have a baby. No, my wife's pregnant and she's due in like 3 weeks, so... my spring is going to be really crazy busy. I pretty much don't have any openings for consulting or anything until the middle to late June. So hopefully I'll be able to get that all put together. The advanced course is going to be a lot more work on my part than the basic course. We're going to go a lot deeper into things like genetics and plant breeding and a lot of other grafting methods and pruning and lots of more in-depth stuff. So,
and on that, we want your feedback at where you want to go next, guys. All of you, not just the caller asking the question right now.
Yes, please.
Because that's going to help Nick develop that course to your desires, because we're absolutely, and this will apply to future students, if you want to take the advanced course, you're going to have had the basic course. I guess if somebody's really badass, they could call you and convince you that they don't need it, but it's probably not going to happen because we're going to see that as like a prerequisite, what you guys have already gone through. So we're going to expect that a student taking the advanced course would have had the knowledge that you guys have now.
Great. Thanks, guys, and congratulations, Nick.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, next person I'm going to call on is from area code 704. You should be able to talk now.
Hey, guys. I had a couple questions about hardwood cuttings. The first one is keep them in a fridge or something like that before you actually root them. And then when you do put them in a rooting medium, are you putting them directly in native soil or do you want to use a sterile potting mix?
You can put them directly in the ground outside. And honestly, that's the easiest way to do it. That's the way... Most nursery trees were grown with hardwood cuttings years ago and before softwood cutting mist systems were invented. So before, you know, the solenoid valves and mist heads and everything came around, everything was propagated with hardwood cuttings. And all they do is they take those cuttings after they'd gone dormant, they would... A lot of them, they wouldn't even use rooting hormone because it just wasn't around. But if they had rooting hormone, they dip it in the rooting hormone and stick it in a row in a field that just got plowed, you know, just like growing row crops. And it would just sit there all winter long. Spring would roll around. The cut would have already calloused and it'll set roots in the spring and it'll grow out and it's... really, really simple.
As simple as that is, answer a question for me then while we're talking about this. What is the percentage of success for most plants in a hardwood versus a softwood? Because the percentage with softwood with misting seems very, very high.
Yeah. Softwood cuttings with an intermittent mist system, you know, most things you're going to have 90 to 100% success rate with. You know, every single cutting, you know, generally takes. You might have a couple out of a couple hundred that don't. But with hardwoods, you know, you might be looking at, you know, 75 to 90% success rate. Generally, they don't all take. It depends on how healthy the stalk is, too. You know, how much energy is embodied in that that piece of wood that you're sticking in the ground. You want to make sure that you're advantaging it to grow roots and not but leaf out too early. If it leafs out before it's calloused, then it's going to fail. So, you know, I like to just put them in the ground. Put them in the ground outside and let them go.
Because it takes a couple seconds.
Okay, so if your ground is frozen or very, very cold by the time you can actually cut them, for example, now,
Now is
just
pretty... Now is pretty late to be taking any hardwood cuttings because now they're getting ready to leaf out. And they would have needed enough time to callus, for that cut to callus over and kind of heal. You know, when you see a wound on a tree and it kind of like rolls over the wound, are you familiar with what that looks like? That's called callusing. So it needs time, enough time for it to heal that over, and it'll do that while it's dormant. So it needs enough time for that to callus so that it can root successfully. So now it's kind of late to be doing that. You might get away with it. So if how frozen is your ground?
It's just starting to thaw. We're about 15 miles from Canada.
Okay. Yeah. Then I'd put them in the fridge and see if it works for you. Put them in the fridge. If you can keep the tops cold, but the bottoms warm. So if you could put it in, let's say you just went to the store and got some potting soil from Lowe's or whatever, and you stuck them in that bag, and you put that bag on top of a waterproof seedling starter mat, and you dipped it in the rooting hormone and everything, and you put it on that heat mat, but it's outside so that the tops are still cold. What'll happen is that will callus a lot quicker. It'll the cut part where it's wanting to root will callus a whole lot quicker, but it will keep the top dormant, so it won't be trying to break bud and put all of its energy into making leaves. And what that'll do is it'll allow you to get those rooted quicker, and you might actually be able to pull it off before they break bud and break dormancy.
So use outdoors as the refrigerator,
right,
and a mat to keep the roots warm.
Right, right.
Wow.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks much.
And
you're
if
welcome.
Nothing else, you'll be able to take softwoods in a few months.
Yep.
All right, here we go. I am going to now call on area code 573. 573, I am unmuting your line right now.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
This is Scott from Central Missouri.
Oh, hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
Pretty good.
My question is about windscreen, a noise screen. It's we call it red cedar here in Central Missouri. Latin name is Juniper virginianus.
Right.
Is it faster to grow this from cuttings or from seed? And if it's faster to grow from seed, where do I get seed?
Okay. I would just type in to Google the Latin name. Most likely you're going to find that Sheffield's has it. I would grow it from seed. A lot of the time, if you're not skilled and experienced trying to root cuttings of conifers, it's going to be a little bit harder to do. So for the price of Eastern Red Cedar, Juniperus virginiana, it's just so cheap to buy seed. Or you might even look at
the plant.
You might be able to harvest the seed yourself, or you might actually check your local ag extension service, and they might have a forestry division where you can buy little seedlings for next to nothing. So that might actually be your best bet for getting those put in the ground. But you know, for me, I'd probably just buy the seed. We're looking at Sheffield's right now, and it's got 63,000 seeds per pound.
$139 a pound, but let's get an ounce price on that.
Here.
So, right, no, I know the price, but I wanted to see how many seeds are there to the ounce.
Oh, okay.
Please calculate the price first. Okay. So an ounce is $20. I'm gonna you go ahead, Nick.
That's a lot of seed.
63,000.
We're going to see how many seeds are in it.
Divide by 16. So you could get 3,937 seeds for that species for $20.
Right.
Assume half of them grow and you sell them for $5 a piece, I think you'd have a pretty good ROI.
Right, so that's what I do.
And that's on Sheffield's, which I'll warn everybody here, since you're plant enthusiasts, be careful with your wallet on that website.
Yeah, be careful.
You'll spend a lot of money fast.
I don't,
yeah, like Christmas in February.
Yeah. I don't have a problem. I can stop any time.
And your meetings are on Wednesday evenings, right?
Right. Yeah. And Thursdays and Saturdays.
But I only go to the meetings for the coffee.
And the seed.
Okay. Is there any others? Are there any others on this kind of setup where you would say it's faster and easier to grow from seed than from cuttings?
Elderberry?
No, actually, elderberry, I do elderberry from softwood cuttings. They're quick and easy. They'll root really readily. And most of the country, you can find it in ditches out in the countryside. So
mm-hmm.
You just go in the spring, after things have started to harden off, you know, probably late June for you, if I had to guess. And snip a whole bunch of that new growth and stick it in a mist bed and grow it.
I think that the primary advantage to seed is you can make a lot easily for very little. I think the other advantage is when you're working, especially with certain things where you're looking to develop new lines of genetics. So, like, I just put about 2,000 sea berries in the stratification seed. So I'm going to grow a ton of seedlings, and you know, I can't even plant that many here, but I'll give them away. And if I can find, you know, this is a plant that really adapts better to the northern climates. If I can find two or three out of all those plants that do well down here, then whoever grew that, because I gave it to them, I want cuttings off of it, and I want to start propagating that. And that starts to get into the whole thing, like the Spiritus Texan Seaberry or something, you know, and you might actually consider paying an attorney. So I think seed has that going for it. You know, when you look at all the named apples we have today, like especially the older apples, like 50% of them were developed in America by people that planted seeds. When you know, the homesteading era boom, there were millions, literally millions of apple trees planted. And if every 10,000 trees, you know, yields one good new apple, you got a lot of apples out of the 1800s that way. So I think that's where seed takes a lot of advantage. Or if you're planting a lot of stuff in the ground where it's going to grow where it's planted, the seed gives you more brilliancy. And let's face it, it's just easier to throw five seeds where one tree is going to go and one of them makes it than it is to dig a hole and put a tree in the ground that you have 2 years of work into.
Right. So basically what it boils down to is, do you need a specific cultivar? If you do, then you need to grow that with cuttings.
Or graft or whatever.
Graft or cuttings. If you just need a lot of a thing, like let's say red maple, you want a ton of red maple. Well, buy red maple seed, because it's not practical to buy the plants, because you can get the amount of time that you would invest into making red maple cuttings from softwood cuttings versus the amount of time that it would take to spread the seed on a seed bed, rake it in, and hit it with some water, it's not even in the same realm. So if you're wanting to grow something that's a lot of open pollinated thing, then just go with seed.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. Good question. We are now going to move on to area code 407. 407, your line should open up in just a second.
Yes, sir. I really appreciated the course. Thank you so much for it, and I'm really looking forward to the advanced class. My question is there a chart or list of what is the best way to propagate the species? I'm not looking for an exhaustive list, but you could do, you know, this tree is hardwood or semi-hardwood, or this tree is only softwood, or, you know, that, and how long it would take for each tree to grow out to cell size, if that makes sense?
No, there's not a list. I'm working on it. It is a lot of data to crunch, and it's a lot of researching involved, so I don't think anyone has ever come up with an exhaustive list. I've found partial lists. In one of the books I have recommended, there's a pretty decent amount of information in there in the form of list like that. But this is what you want to think about is about 90% of anything that you want to propagate through asexual means, like a cutting, is going to do great in an intermittent myth system. And as far as how long it takes to grow that up to sellable, well, that all depends on how big of a plant you're wanting to sell and how big of a plant the customer wants to buy. Give yourself a couple months for the thing to root, and I would say at that time, most things are going to be sellable. They're going to be more delicate at that point. But
you're going to sell that to the educated customer.
Right.
I'll buy it, but Joe Blow off the street probably won't.
Expect that you're going to take cuttings this spring and sell them the next spring or in the fall.
Yeah, dormant in the fall or bloomed out in the spring. And I would say to try to create, if you're going to do this as a business, to try to create a seasonal flow of your workload. One of the reasons I love the nursery business for folks is that a lot of you guys aren't just going to go into business tomorrow and quit your job. So you're in this kind of space where you're working and you're trying to build a business. And by creating a seasonal flow to it, you can load the main work into certain sections, and you can also load the cash flow into certain sections of the season. So, I mean, that's what I'd say. Like, if you're doing cuttings this spring, you might sell some in the fall. If you're going to sell them freshly rooted, you're probably, honestly, we're going to try to work now to start building up kind of a network of you guys to each other, because that is very powerful. So, one of the other people on the phone right now might be rooting the hell out of blackberry, and you might have a market to sell blackberry once it's rooted. Well, if you sell somebody rooted cuttings where all you've done is root them, and they need to be potted and they need to be grown out for a while before they're sold, you're going to sell those cheap. But how long does it take to yank 100 cuttings out of your misting bed, wrap up the roots in newspaper and damp, and put it in a priority mailbox and send it for $7 across the country to another grower who can put those in pots and have them for sale by fall? And by being able to work back and forth with each other doing that, I think you guys can leverage a lot of efforts, because everybody's going to focus on a few things. And in fact, I think Nick would agree. We all get starry-eyed with all this crap we want to grow, but focus on 4, 5, 6 things in your first year and get really good with those 4 to 5, 6 things. And then all of a sudden, those 6 things are things I didn't grow. I'm the kind of guy, $3 a cutting, I'll buy 100 cuttings from you. You invoice me on PayPal, I'll send you the payment, and I expect it here in a week. I mean, that, and we do that all the time. And I'm doing that with blackberry this year, 200 blackberry cuttings, and we're going to sell most of them. We're just going to throw them in pots, nursery pots, and we'll grow them up into midsummer. And right when the box stores are all out of them and Sally Homemaker has just decided, I should have bought some blackberries, we'll sell them for $8 a piece. And the grower made money, I made money, and we got our plants for free. And then we have stock to make next year. I don't have to buy them. I have them all over the place.
And honestly, the customer gets a better product than what they would have bought at Lowe's or Home Depot.
No doubt. No doubt. The roots, when I've bought rooted cuttings for backyard growers, the cuttings are better than the plants. The quality, you can just see the quality of the plant because we care.
Healthy. Yeah.
Yeah. Make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. Thank you very much. And Jack, are you going to make your PV2 speech, a presentation, available on the podcast like you did last year?
Boy, I'm so glad you asked that. What I actually think I'm going to do is I am going to take the PV2 speech, and since Diego sells the audio of that, instead of releasing it publicly, I'm going to make it available to all members of this course and all members of our PDC only. The other thing is, and I'm so glad you said this, I'm going to put this out on this call today. My wife's not going to PV2. I could really use an assistant out there to like sell my disk drives and stuff like that and help me with organization. So anybody that's on this call right now, if you send me an email with PV2 assistant in the subject line, before I put it out on, Tuesday, I'll put it out on the air. If I don't get anybody from here, I'll give it first to somebody here that wants to do it. You have to commit to being at PV2. You have to provide your own transportation and lodging, but I'll give you a free ticket. So anybody that wants to, let's not talk about it, but anybody that wants to do that, send me an email. That's kind of a bonus to people that showed up on a Sunday for a call like this.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you said that because I really did completely flake on that. I was going to do it yesterday. People are going to be mad now. Anyway, area code 512, I believe that's Austin. Your line should open up in just a second.
Hi, this is Jake, just outside of Austin in the Round Mountain area. Question for Nick and Jack. In this Central Texas environment, you're talking about, you know, focus on 4 to 6 particular species to start. What would be your recommendations?
I can tell you what I'm doing, but it might not necessarily be what you would want to do. You know, I'm focusing. I figure if it grows here, in you know, limestone rock and 5 inches of soil, it'll grow anywhere. I'm really focusing on goji because it's a high dollar plant and it propagates like stupid easy.
And it likes alkaline soil.
It likes alkaline soil. I'm doing a lot with apple, and I'm doing with apple for a variety of reasons. People know what they are and they sell well. We like to eat apples. They deal with alkalinity just fine, so they are adapted. And you know, I'm working toward the cider side of things because I know that even with my small property, I can have by the end of next year 150 varieties of apples on my property. And I can't ever grow commercial levels of them here, but I can sure produce a lot of Scion. Nick's living with so much Scion, he doesn't know what he's going to do just from what's here now. So apples, gojis. I'm also focusing on blackberry because it grows here. And I think that's part of it is to put in a diverse array of things, and you can buy nursery stock. And instead of buying 20, buy one. And one produces, you know, a tremendous amount of cuttings. I'm not focusing on blueberries because they die here. Now, just because we're in the same climate doesn't mean we're in the same soil type. So if your soil, I doubt it, but if your soil is acidic, then you can put, you know, rabbit eye and southern variety blueberries in and they'll do good. My view is, if again, if we're really focused toward kind of the backyard nursery thing here, I think the easiest way to sell a person a plant when it's a little bitty plant in a pot is to point at one doing beautiful on your property and say, take care of it for 2 years, it'll look like this. So I would say put stuff in and see what does well. And you know, you could say it's the climate, but if you have irrigation, it's a totally different story than if you don't have irrigation. So, you know, did it rain? It doesn't matter if there's a dripper sitting next to the tree. So you have to think about that too. But for me, it's blackberry, it's goji, it's apple, it's plums. Those of everything I put in, those are all the ones that I get a lot of diversity in or a lot of utility in, and they're here. I've grown a lot of hybrid things that are like, you know, the plum cots and stuff like that, but that's not really good for propagation because we're back to the patented thing.
Right.
Peaches, too. Peaches, I mean, Texas, figs. Peaches, figs. Oh, where you're at, you're even further south than me. There's the figs are another thing that will end up with the Wednesday meeting that you go to only for the coffee, because you start digging into figs, you realize there's like 500 kabillion varieties of figs. But like what grows here really well? LSU Purple, Celeste, Brown Turkey, Chicago Hardy.
Any of them. Yeah. Any of them will grow great for you there.
Yeah, better than me. You know, you don't get as severe a winter freeze as I do. But, you know, those four really do well, and they sell. And it's something that people can look at in a store and see, okay, it's $14.50 at Lowe's. Here's one that looks a lot better for $10. You know, and that's... If you could be a little less than they are, which you can because you don't have their multiple chain distribution system where everybody has to take a piece, and you can look better, you can outsell them. But if you go into figs, instead of having the three that they have at Lowe's, if you can find some other figs and find out the story behind them. This is what we talked about yesterday on the call for those that were here, or I should say more for those that weren't here. If you can find out, like, where did this fig come from? How did it end up being propagated here? Because a lot of times with figs, it's some Italian guy planted it in his backyard in New Jersey, and it survived, and some guy went and took a cutting, and he took it to this nursery, and that nursery started selling it, and now it's available. If you can find that kind of story, then you can tell your customer that story, and then they want to grow that fig, because everybody does everything to their property, either because it's something they really want themselves, or ego. And the ego side is when you put your own drywall in or your own flooring in or you redid your own bathroom, every person that comes over, you want to show them, hey, this is what we did. and people like to tell stories. So if you could tie that to it, but figs are great. Grapes do pretty good here, believe it or not. Muscadines do beautifully.
Muscadines will do well.
And they
down
root
there.
Like that. And there's like a kabillion different varieties of open variety muscadine. I don't know if it's as easy as sale. And don't, like, I know we're all prepper, survivalist, permaculturist, and we focus a lot on food, but a lot of ornamental stuff sells well too, so.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Look into the ornamental stuff. See what your drive through some yuppie neighborhoods and snap some pictures of the types of plants that everyone wants to plant. Find out what they are, identify them, and find out if you can propagate them and cultivate them. Because I tell you what, I'd rather sell 1,000, you know, spireas for $5 a piece than sell 50 blueberry bushes for $5 a piece.
Sure.
You know, if sure. I'm just trying to make money off of a business, you know, I need to sell what my market wants.
And if we want to create, you know, my grand plan for taking over the world of putting edible food in everybody's backyard, again, what do you need? The first transaction with the customer. So if I sell them spirea or blue salvia sage, that would be a great one. Okay, if I wanted to do something in Texas that would be good for the environment and sells as an ornamental, the blue salvia, because you go into a Walmart parking lot where there's six packs of it everywhere, and you hear humming of the bees. So
right.
It's a trick, right? You get them to put this plant in.
Right. So you know, like what Jack was just saying, find things that are not only beneficial for, you know, beneficial insects, hummingbirds, bees. You know, find things that have that component, but are also attractive.
Rose of Sharon for hummingbirds. We have one outside my window, and it's covered with those little green hummingbirds every year.
So, you know, you can – that's a sales hot-button thing right now, save the bees. Everyone – you know, someone who has no interest in having bees on their property might be interested in saving the bees. So get a whole bunch of things and say, this is bee-friendly. Bees go bonkers over this thing, or – this will bring in hummingbirds. You know, those are things that people like. And not only is it pretty, but it has that other, you know, aspect to it.
How about this? The birds and bees package, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So you get a hummingbird vine, you get some Rose of Sharon, you get some blue salvia sage, one or two other flowers that we know are really attractive, perennials that are really attractive to bees. You put that in a package, six plants, you know, one of each, and it's $30. It's the birds and bees package. You know, that's...
And what you want to do with that is don't put the same price on each of those packaged items.
Yeah, knock seven a piece and then five in a package.
Yeah, knock your price down 10-15% for the package, maybe even 20%, because if you can get that person to buy a package of things for $50 versus one thing for $5 off of that first sale, it doesn't matter. If they're going to buy something, if they'll buy – the package deal because, ooh, that's a deal. It's a sale.
Yeah.
They might be a little bit more inclined to buy it because it's a sale price.
Yeah.
And not only have you made the first sale, but you've made some more money than you would have. Like what?
That's called ARPU, average revenue per unit. That's something every person that's in business needs to think about. How do you increase your average transaction price? More so than how much you make off the individual unit, as long as the individual unit is profitable. And I'd say if you were going to sell your plants for $5 a piece and put them in a package, sell your plants for $6 a piece and $5 a piece in your package. Jack your unit price up. Because if a guy comes in and goes, well, I kind of like this, but $30, you know, it's not expensive to make these plants. So you say, you know what, instead of $30, how about you buy two of them for $50, $25 a piece? You know, be willing to haggle with people because they feel like they got an advantage. But honestly, if you were selling that package for $50 for two, 12 plants, you'd want to sell as many of them as you can.
And if it costs you $5 and 5 minutes of your time to propagate the thing and pot it up, well, that's a big win.
Yeah.
You know, things like plumbago and hydrangea, you'll find those in a 2 or 3 gallon pot and you'll have, you know, $3 into materials, the potting mix, and the pot, and the cutting was 30 seconds of your time.
Yeah.
And now you can sell for $30.
So you take your birds and bees package, and you say, now that you're going to have bees, it'd be cool if you had two apple trees in your backyard, too. Oh, I don't have room for apples. Oh, let me show you an apple pruned to head height. This is what it looks like. This is what you do. I've already set this tree up to be done that way. It's been trained in the plot that way. Take it home. Do this with it. You need two for cross-pollination. Put your bird and bee thing in between them. And, you know, and also now you've sold a $50 package plus two apple trees, you know, or a fig, you know, or whatever. I know we went longer than you probably intended when you asked, but hopefully we gave you some plans to go with the questions.
No, all great stuff. Thanks, guys.
All right, let's see. I will mute this person.
Let's go to the bottom.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Run to the bottom for the people who have been waiting the longest, and I will come to area code 505. You should be unmuted any second now.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for this class. It's really, really good. I was wondering if you want to sell organic, maybe certified organic plants, what would you use for like a seed starter mix or a potting mix, and also how would you fertilize, like how much and when and that kind of thing to keep it like certified organic?
All right. I'm going to give you my thoughts on certified organic, and you can choose to do that if you want to. I am never, ever, ever, ever infinity going to try to become certified organic.
As a nursery.
As a nursery. It is, I'm just inviting old Uncle Sam to stick his fingers and his nose and other things into my business. And I don't want any more oversight than I have to have. I understand that there's kind of a market for certified organic. To be honest with you, I have no idea what you would have to do because I've never looked into.
You'd have to use all materials that were already approved organic materials. You'd have to keep your records. You'd have to basically certify yourself as though you were a farm. And
it's expensive.
It's
to maintain that certification.
Here's the thing. So if you bought a bunch of trees for me for your organic apple orchard and you planted them, you're not judged on whether or not you're organic based on my apples but on your practices. So there's really not that much of an advantage in the first place for you to source an organic certified plant. There's plenty of organic farms that are not using certified organic seed. When you see certified organic seed, all it means is that seed came from organic produce. And I just don't believe there's a compelling enough reason to spend more for an organic plant, because what I do with it the day I bring it home is more important. But the way you would do it, you would have to go through the general organic certification program. You'd have to keep, you have in organic certification, you have to keep records, daily records of everything you do and don't do. And every product you use has to be approved for organic certification. And I don't even know of a nursery selling organic certified trees. So that kind of tells me no one's doing it. I do think there's a compelling story to tell with natural propagation to say that, like, we're not sending you home with a tree coated in nicotinoids, but I think, like, I would stay under, like, the umbrella of all natural propagation, if that makes sense.
Right. You know, if I'm talking to a customer and they say, is this organic? I'm going to say no, because I don't do the certified organic program. But I'll tell you what I don't use is anything that is toxic. The spray that I use for my trees, I also use to wash my hands with because it's soapy water. You know, here is everything that I use. If you'd like to look at the packages, you know, I use essential oils and I use this, you know, Castile soap, and I use my well water, and you know, so everything I'm doing is not only organic, but it's beyond organic, and so I think my product is better than what you're allowed to do with certified organic.
And again, I don't think there is a such thing as an organic certified tree. I've never seen. I mean, I go through every nursery catalog that I can get my hands on. I've never seen these trees are certified organic. I don't even know if the program is made for that.
It might not.
So what if you wanted to just okay, not be certified organic, but you wanted to use all organic products instead of buying these starting mixed by Miracle-Gro?
Yeah, that's a very good point. What you could do is say every product we use is a certified or approved for organic, you know, product. And you could market that. You can't call your thing organic, though, okay, because that's a government stepped in there. But yes, you could do that. You could say all our products are approved for organic production. That would be the loophole, and I think that would be a good, compelling story. And it's kind of the same thing Nick's doing. He's just phrasing it differently.
Right.
But again, I don't think there's a such thing as an organic certified tree to plant on your property, because it's all about the management thereafter, and I think that's where you're at with it.
So what would you use, though? Like, you know, I've done enough growing stuff in pots, and I know, I mean, the big growers, they use, like, Osmocote and Miracle-Gro and these other things to, and they've got it all figured out. Like, here's how much you fertilize, here's when you fertilize. So how would you do all of that and keep it organic just for your own peace of mind and to keep all those chemicals off your land, and then you can honestly say, hey, I don't use any chemicals?
Right. Okay. So what you're going to do.
Hold on real quick. I'm going to ahead and mute in that line because we're getting a lot of feedback from it. Nick's going to answer that question, and then we'll go on to the next person, because you can do that. And that's part of the information is actually in your course, but go ahead.
Right. So if you're starting seeds, you're going to use, sterilize your own potting soil that you made.
You have aphids, you're going to use soap.
Right, you have aphids, you use soap, so it's organic. You want to fertilize them, use compost tea, use comfrey tea, make your own compost and fertilizer mix out of herbs that you harvest, and you ferment those down, and you make a fertilizer spray out of those herbs. Look into biodynamic stuff. That's, you know, you can go the whole biodynamic route and meet all your fertility needs like that, and use everything that is certified organic for your sprays and stuff like that.
Yeah, if you do buy something instead of make it, buy an organic product,
right,
and you know you're organic.
use compost for your fertilizer. Just use compost. Period.
And if
done.
You use compost tea, then you have another business unit. Start bottling it up and selling it to your customers when they buy plants from you. I mean, it's really not a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
The reason mass nurseries do it is because many times the pure volume dealing with.
It's quick, it's easy, it's cheap to use the blue stuff. It works, and it keeps the plants alive, and then they just send it out. So if you're wanting to do everything organic and everything that you would do if it was certified organic, just use your own potting soil that you made with compost and what have you, and do it like that. Yeah.
Use blood and bone for your fertilizer.
Right.
If you need to shot up some nitrogen or whatever, and pretend you have an organic farm instead of a nursery. I mean, that's, I guess, the best I can do. Let's go on to area code 910. Your line should open up in just a second. 910, you should be open.
Hey, guys.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I had actually emailed in the question ahead of time so you could get a visual of some of the pictures of what I'm working with.
Okay.
I just wanted to get a general idea of the core plants that I wanted to work with, which is the autumn olive, gumi, sea berry, and goji berry.
Okay.
And how you would guild those together and out in the field with other plants.
Hmm. Well, I mean, when you look at autumn olive, you look at gumi, you look at two, call them very, very similar fraternal twin sisters. And you look at sea berry, you're looking at those three are all nitrogen fixers. So it's not so much they gild together, but they gild with anything that needs a nitrogen fixer. They're all shrub layer, and they all have their own unique selling points. Your selling point of autumn olive is you can make a whole lot of it really cheap, and it's really cool, and it's easy to propagate, and it's awesome the downside is that it's considered a bit invasive because it self-propagates so easily through bird droppings and all. So your gumi is really kind of geared toward the person that wants something with a little bit higher food value. They're a little bit bigger, they're a little bit sweeter, they're a little bit less astringent, and they're a little harder to propagate from seed, so they don't tend to go invasive. So it's kind of like those are almost the same plant, right? But they have a little bit different characteristics. And then there's some of your designer autumn olives that, you know, almost get into that level of sellability as a gumi. Your sea buckthorn is also a nitrogen fixer, but totally different plant. It's an incredible medicinal, but again, it's a nitrogen fixer. So those three all kind of occupy the same exact space in a guild. Shrub layer, nitrogen fixer. Your kind of wild card out of that group is your goji. It also highly medicinal, high food value, easy propagation. You can sell anything from, you know, 2-3 year old roots to rooted cuttings, dried berries, leaves make tea. You can do the leaves as fermented black tea. So they have all this story that goes with it, but it's still, it's a shrub layer, but it's not a nitrogen fixer. So all of them fit in that shrub layer. So they're going to gild with trees and herbaceous plants.
Right.
They don't really gild. It's not that they can't go in the same gilding, but they don't really gild with each other so much as they are. They're filling that layer. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would find other things that will work in your situation, your zone, your area, your soil, and give you what you would like to have that will gild with those things. Because you're looking at the tires on the truck and wondering, how do I make a truck out of this? Well, you need, you know, the windshield and the cab and the bed and everything else to go with it.
Yeah.
So I would look at other things that will work in your area for your situation that you can plug in around those, you know, things like comfrey and echinacea, you know, some herbaceous layer things, maybe a couple trees that will benefit from the nitrogen fixing and the shade, keeping the soil cool and moist from those shrubs.
And I mean, if you're in southern climate like I am, a lot of your trees get the trunks get really hammered. And so when Nick was out doing pruning yesterday on my property, he was kind of impressed with how little sun scald there was on all those trees. And that's because the first couple of years, what I've been using is tall growing annuals like sunflower and sorghum and stuff and pea vine to shade those trees. But what I'm trying to transition to is, I mean, I'm using autumn olive as my autumn olive and goji are filling that primary role here, specifically because if I have a shrub around the trunk of a tree up to the point where it branches out, it's not going to get sun scalded. I don't have to go paint whitewash on it like Huck Finn.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That those plants in and around some fruit trees and some brambles running down lower and even some higher-end medicinal plants down at the ground layer, kind of gilding all that together and selling that as a package.
Yeah, just make sure that you're when you're planting all this stuff, you're leaving room for access because you need to be able to get in there and inspect your tree, prune it, and harvest. So don't fill it around with things that are prickly and thorny like brambles and sea berry.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you do that around your tree, you've effectively fenced yourself off and you won't be able to access it.
Or more importantly, you probably won't do that, but when you sell the package to a customer,
right?
You know, if you're selling it like I've called it several times, build a guild. Right. If you're selling it to a customer that way, if you sell them like a diagram, be specific on your distances. Because I can take something like a sea berry and I can use it to shade the trunk of my apple, and I can still keep it far enough away from that apple to not be getting cut up by the seed, because they will cut you. I mean, the thorns on those are dramatically impressive, but they're a very, what is the word, cylindrical, columnar style plant. So with a pretty moderate spacing and topping at, let's say, neck height, if I'm growing an apple up, you know, with the crown up over my head, I can use a couple of those and maybe a gumi pruned down lower and a couple blackberries to create that shade on that that trunk. But like Nick's saying, if I gild it straight up against her, it'll grow just fine. But God help you when you got to get in there. And you don't want your customer coming back to you going, well, how do I prune this now? Well, I would suggest cutting it to the ground, mulching over it, and replanting your blackberries and sea berries. You don't want to – I mean, you might get another sale out of it, but you don't have a happy customer at that point.
I was thinking the thornier stuff, favoring more of the fruit veggies.
Right. Yep.
Kind of a bordering situation.
Yep. Sounds good to me.
But we're in southeast North Carolina here, zone 8, and we just went through our coldest weather of the year, hopefully about 9-10 degrees Thursday.
Nothing that you're talking about has any problem with that, though.
Yeah, no. You can grow almost everything that people are going to want to grow in your climate.
Yeah. Goji is the most tender out of that whole list you gave, and it's good to zone 6. So it's not even struggling.
Yeah.
And I've seen it grown in zone 5, so, yeah. Anyway, I think we're going to...
I ended up building a propagation bed from the plant propagation force from the Permaethos. And I built it in the greenhouse, so I ended up building a greenhouse in the greenhouse, and I kept it from freezing with just using a little Walmart heater through this cold weather. So
cool.
Everything's doing well. I got I rooted rosemary in 4 weeks. I just checked them yesterday, and they've already rooted.
Well, good.
So you could definitely do a multifunctional in a greenhouse in the greenhouse, I guess.
Good deal.
I want to move on, not to cut you short or nothing, but we do have a lot of questions, and I want to make sure we answer as many as we can during this call because we're down into the second hour now. I'm calling on area code 240 at this time. 240, go with your question.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
Okay, I'm in eastern Tennessee, and my question is, I don't have any running water right now. Can I create enough water pressure by elevating a 275-gallon tank to run a misting system? My plan is to pump water from a creek on my property, and I realistically won't be able to set up water catchment until closer to the end of this year.
You need a pump. Do you have electricity?
Yes.
Then I would recommend, you probably weren't on yesterday's call, there's a SureFlow pump. I would recommend using a pump for the pressure because you're going to put in a freaking city height water tower to get that kind of pressure.
Yeah, what you're going to need to do is you're going to need to pump your water from your creek to a tank, and you're going to unless you have that pump ready to pump all the time and there's always water in that creek, you're going to need a whole lot more than 240 or 200-something gallons. And what you're going to want to do is it's going to need to be filtered before it goes in there, and then that's going to need to go to a pressure tank. So you're going to have to pump into the pressure tank, and the pressure tank will shut off just like a well, and that pressure tank will feed to your mist system with that solenoid valve. So what it's going to do is every time the solenoid valve clicks on, it's going to draw from that pressure tank, and the pressure tank will refill once it gets low enough from your reservoir tank. Does that make sense?
That does.
And
okay.
And the pump I'd recommend to put between the holding tank, if you're going to pump water, probably with some big, sump pump or something like that you're going to throw down in the creek, but to get the water from the tank into the pressure tank, right, you're going to need another pump, and that's going to push it through the filter and into that pressure tank. And the pump I'd recommend you use, they're only about $75, and they're on Prime, I think. No, they're not on Prime anymore. Maybe Steven sold too many. It's called a SureFlow, S-U-R-F-L-O. It's a 198-gallon-per-hour pump. I'm going to give you the model number right now, so you might want to write it down. 2088-594-154. I'll repeat it for everybody else. 2088-594-154. And if you search Amazon for that, you'll find it. And I've got one here set up just the way we're talking about. And, it runs off standard AC. If you look at this pump and you want to run it off solar or something like that, they make a DC version. It's the exact same pump, but DC.
Okay. Just a little bit of follow-up. Based on what you guys are saying, I don't think I'm going to have enough time to do something that involved to get it done this year. Do you think I should still start fruit and support trees from seed in the meantime? And I was going to buy a couple mature plants to plant this year to try to take cuttings from next season.
If you're wanting to do like apple trees, pears, peaches, plums, cherries, those kinds of things, you're not going to want to propagate those through a mist bed anyways. You're going to want to take cyanwood when it's dormant and graft it when, at right before bud break, when sap starts flowing, when things are coming out of dormancy. So you're going to want to graft a lot of those fruit varieties. Now, if they're the more uncommon things like goji, gumi, blueberry, you know, bushes, things that are growing on their own rootstock, their own roots, not grafted things, those things are best to grow from in a mist bed with softwood cuttings. Now, what area of the country are you in?
Eastern Tennessee. I'm on the Cumberland Plateau.
Okay, so you're looking at June, mid to late June, when things are going to be hardening off for most things will be hardening off to take softwood cuttings in June. So
what we're talking about doing isn't really that. If you have to pump water to a tank anyway, I mean, this you can get this pump for $75. You can get a pressure tank. It sounds
$75 too.
$75 at Home Depot.
Yeah.
You push the water in the pressure tank. The pressure tank pushes the water to the mist bed. I mean, it's something you could install. And if you've never done it before and you have to go to YouTube to figure a few things out, it's a one-day project.
It is the exact same setup as pumping from a well to a pressure tank to a house. It's the exact same setup. It's going from the pressure tank to your mist bed.
That's a one-hour job for a plumber.
Yeah.
It really is. It's not.
Okay, awesome. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Cool. Okay, we're going to eat that line and go to our next caller. Caller from 303. You will be on the air in just a second. You should hear your line open up. Well, we'll try it again. Hold on. Isn't technology wonderful? 303, you should be on the air now.
Hey, Jack, this is Rob in Colorado. How you doing?
Good, man.
And Nick, good to see you, too. Hey, I've got a question on your video. I'm only about halfway through. I got busy in the middle of it, but I noticed you talked about briefly about vermiculite for starting seed and
right.
Also potting soil.
Right.
Does it matter which type is used for what kind of plant? I was thinking about doing a larger flat for starting a bunch of plants and then pricking them off and putting them into larger planting pots to get them started our seasons a little bit later here, and I'd like to get a good start on them so I can transplant fully mature plants into the ground when the weather is right.
Right. There's really not much difference between the vermiculite and potting soil as far as starting. Generally, the vermiculite is going to be sterile, and potting soils often aren't. I like the vermiculite because it holds moisture well. It's sterile because it is basically popcorned mica. It's just the mineral mica, and they put it in an oven, and they heat it up, and the mica is really thin layers. Like, think about a ream of paper. You have all those layers where there's layers of mica, and then in between those layers is a little bit of moisture, and then when they bake it, the steam forces those layers to pop open, and now you have kind of an expanded, almost sponge-type thing, and that holds a lot of moisture. And they baked it at high temperatures, so it's sterile. And then they bag it up. It's all sterile. It's great. You know, it's almost foolproof as far as disease prevention goes. So that's why I like the vermiculite. And as far as starting them, you know, you can put a whole packet of 25 tomato seeds in a 4-inch section. You get them up to just when they start putting out the little buds for the true leaves, and you prick them out and plant them in your 6-packs or in 4-inch pots, whatever size pot you're wanting to put them in. So as far as seed size goes, it doesn't matter. You just need to, you know, treat the seeds the same way you would treat them in the vermiculite as you would in potting soil or in your garden. Cover them 1 to 1.5 times the length of the longest part of the seed. And keep them moist.
All right, great, thanks.
No problem.
All right, we'll move on to the next question that we have. Again, for those, I hear people come in and out, so 5-star is how you raise your electronic hand for me. I'm going to call on area code 385. 385, you should be on the air.
Howdy, Jack. This is Jonathan again.
Hey, Jonathan.
I have a question concerning general knowledge, really. I've seen many different people, including yourselves and a guy out in Perma Ethos, Rob, you may have met him, just walk around and is able to point out this tree is that, and just a wealth of knowledge. And I'm wondering, how do I acquire that sort of stuff, you know? How do I acquire that knowledge?
If you're talking about
trees, what would you suggest?
If you're talking about trees, get an Audubon tree guide and go out there and just put in the time. Look at the tree, identify the tree. Say, I'm going to identify this tree. You look at the bark, you look at the twigs, you look at the leaves. Sometimes with some oaks, the only thing differentiating two different species of oak is the underside of the leaf will have a little bit of fuzz in the crotches of the veins of the leaf. You know? So,
wow.
So, you know, you'll need to look through books on tree identification, weed identification. Find some books on common weeds in your area and how to identify them. You can get field guides for that stuff. And I just go out and look at your field guide and see, you know, what are – look up on Google. What are the 20 most common garden weeds in your area? And you'll come up with blog posts and here's 20 most common crazy weeds in your area. And look at those weeds, learn how to identify them, and go find them. And learn how to identify them in different stages of growth. So, you know, learn what they look like in the spring. Learn what they look like in the summer, in the fall, and in the winter when they're dormant. Learn what the seedlings look like so you can identify when those weeds are popping up in your garden and not pull out your lettuce seedlings instead.
I mean, understand that, like, okay, you see me walk through and go, okay, this is this, right? Okay, it's years. It's also, there's probably another 50 plants there that I'm ignoring and not pointing out that I don't know what they are, right? So that's another side of it. Like, and then there's another piece to this. It doesn't actually take as long as you would think, because if you taught yourself two plants a week for a year, it's 100 plants. And that's a lot to have. Now, then what starts to happen is, and we talk about this in permaculture, pattern recognition.
Right, right.
So I'll see a tree, and I don't know what it is, but I know it's probably a legume because it has the pattern of a leguminous tree. Or I'll see a tree and I don't know what variety it is, but I know damn well it's an apple. Right? And so, you know, that's – go to nurseries, walk through, look at the plants. And when you see a plant that's new to you, don't just try to remember that plant and something about it. Take in its pattern. How does it branch? What's the color of its bark? What's the texture of its bark? What's the shape of its leaf?
Right.
Right. You know, I'm not a botanist. I can't tell you, oh, this is ovate and this is – I don't think that way. But when I see that leaf, I go, oh, that's a maple. Right? And then what kind of maple? I don't know, but at least I know what to start to figure out.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Learn the key features of oaks. Learn the key features of hickories. Et cetera, et cetera. You know, find out what those normal things are that all of this genus has, and you'll at least be able to narrow things down to the genus. And then from there on, it's pretty easy to, you know, nail down what the species is.
Because I'll be honest with you, I got plants on this property that grow wild that are some sort of weed, and I don't know what they are. But I know this, either my geese and ducks eat them or they don't. And if nothing eats it, and it doesn't seem to be doing much good, I'm not real happy about it, right? But if something eats it, I don't give a damn what it is, right? I actually do. I want to find out. And I've done what Nick's talking about. I've bought area guidebooks, you know, Texas wildflowers, Texas weeds. And I prefer a book that breaks – and I think the easiest time to identify most plants, you have no idea what they are, is when they're in flower. Because most of the books will at least break down white flowers, yellow flowers, blue flowers, purple flowers, pink flowers. And if I can get at least on the flower page, I can just like, okay, I know what the leaf looks like. I just start paging through that. Does the flower and the leaf look like it? And I'll probably find two or three suspects. Then I'll get out there with the guidebook, and I'll sit down and I'll look at the actual leaf structure, and I'll look at the description. Now it'll say, you know, leaves have 5 to 6 points or whatever, or the flower is this way. There's X number. And I'll look down to that level if I'm not sure.
Right. another one of those pinch points where it becomes really easy to identify a species is the seed. A lot of seeds are different. You know, they're unique. So if you can identify what it looks like by the flower and the seed and the bark and the leaf, there's not a whole lot else that's, you know, a specific when you look at it from a general viewpoint.
But don't think that we just know everything, because Nick and I have stood in the woods many times looking at a plant and spending 20 minutes trying to figure out what it is, and somebody walks by and goes, oh, that's whatever, and we're like, duh.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's obviously what was it?
Yeah.
Spiceberry.
Yeah,
we were up in Perma Ethos, and we're like, what the hell is this? Guy goes by, oh, spiceberry. We're like,
oh, yeah.
No shit.
Duh.
And you feel stupid, you know? Or, I was looking at this plant in Arkansas over and over, like, what the hell is this? And then it put berries on, and I'm like, oh, it's American Beauty Berry. You can see it from 1,000 miles away when it's got berries on it. But up until it puts berries on it, it looks like every other plant in the woods.
Yeah.
Don't ever think we're smarter than we are, because we're not.
Much appreciated. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jonathan.
We're going to go on to the next person here. I am going to call on area code 720. 720, your line is open once again.
The plant nursery is something that would fall under the guidelines for your AgriTrue label or potentially Perma Ethos. I know you were talking about initially 40 to 200 acre farms.
I would say far more Perma Ethos than AgriTrue. AgriTrue is really a food thing, and the truth is that we have, I have partners in that business, and it's hard to get a lot done, and I'm putting my time and effort into Perma Ethos. I'll leave it at that for now. We're trying to figure out how to take that to another level, but I only have so much individual personal bandwidth, and that bandwidth, what's available, is going here right now. The nursery course is here right now. I would love to see a Perma Ethos Nursery Growers Network develop out of this. That's our goal. The people that will be part of that will all have to be people that have taken this course and at least the next course to be, let's say, blessed. But the network itself would be made up of anybody that's taken at least this course. Because then we know that you know what we say you know that you know, if that makes sense. But that would be really under here. And my hope is not just that we can create an umbrella brand that becomes like, because here's how I see it. Like, I don't see most of us wanting to ever be like Callaway's or Mike's, right? Mm-hmm. We just don't. It's too much. You end up needing to employ 50 people to do that, first of all. And it's seasonal work, and that means you can't really treat your people the way you want to. And you're looking at big retail fronts, but that doesn't mean we can't maybe have collectively the reach of Callaway's or Mike's, so that you could be able to eventually go on Perma Ethos and find Perma Ethos certified nurseries, backyard nurseries, know your nurseryman, that type of thing, like we do with food, in your back, your own, regional backyard, and be able to go and find someone like that to buy from. So that's where I'd like to go. But then that's one layer. The other layer, and I think the layer to build first, is you guys all having each other as resources. Because there's plenty of stuff. Nick's like, you want some seed for this or that? I'm like, no, you're going to grow the shit out of that. When you get your stuff up, I'll buy some plants off you, and I'm producing this, and I'll, we'll trade plants. I want you guys buying from each other, trading from each other. But I see that all as a Perma Ethos house, so to speak, not really an AgriTrue house.
Okay. That's also, I would imagine, quite a ways down the road.
I hope it's not that far down the road. Honestly, I think it's about you guys. I mean, if we have a dozen, two dozen people out there that legitimately are selling plants to the public, that's a network, man. That's if I put up a site and it says, find one of our certified nurserymen, and it's me and Nick, Saline, Louisiana and Fort Worth, Texas, it's not really a network yet. But if it's, if there's a dozen people across the country, it's a building block. And that kind of a site is not something we need to hire somebody from India to build over 6 months. That's a site that we can use a WordPress plugin and a little bit of hacking to put together. As far as you guys dealing with each other, we're going to be adding a board to the Perma Ethos forums. that's just for this.
Right.
And you guys can start doing that now. I mean, there's no one out there that couldn't make 1,000 cuttings of something this year. Every single one of you could do that and just start. What you guys could do is like start a forum. Like, I can do this. I can do that. I can do this. And then just at the end of the season, just everybody swap, you know, 5% with each other. And all of a sudden, there you have diversity. So on stuff like that, that's like we can give you the board to do it in, but you guys have to take the initiative and get it done.
Gotcha. Second question. Do you have a ballpark timeline of when you might be putting together the advanced course for this?
Again, we answered this earlier. The ballpark would be this fall. This time next year. I'm going to try and get it out as soon as I can. I've got a baby due to be born in like 3 weeks, and my spring is so busy, I don't even have a weekend available for consulting until the middle of June. And you know, I have my own little homestead, farmstead to run. I've got my nursery business to run, so I'm going to be working on that, but I don't want to promise anything right now because I don't know what the rest of this year is going to hold. My hope is to have it done by this upcoming winter.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. No problem. Okay. Jack just stepped out, so I am going to go on to the next caller, and we're going to go area code 410. 410, you should be on the air now.
Hey, Nick, this is James in Maryland. I've got access to a high tunnel, and my question is relative to hardwood and softwood cuttings. Do you think there's like any kind of value there in the process?
As far as growing them in the high tunnel, I'd be growing hardwood cuttings in the open air out in a you know, somewhere that you would put an annual garden, and the softwood cuttings, they'd be in a bed. The benefit to the high tunnel would be wind protection, and you could throw a shade cloth over the top of it and protect them from too much sun exposure and from drying winds. So, yeah, if you can grow inside that high tunnel with your softwood cuttings, I prefer to have my hardwood cuttings out exposed to the elements, though.
Okay, cool, man. Thanks for answering that one. And then if you got a second, I just had one small question relative to tuber storage.
Okay.
And just sort of like a generally good temperature and growing medium, if there's like a kind of overall maybe medium that's pretty good.
Nick will come back and probably give you a better answer. A lot of my tubers that I store that are edible tubers, like Jerusalem artichokes and what have you, the way I store them is I take them and I put them in a big 2 gallon Ziploc bag, and I take one or two pieces of paper towel and dampen them, and I put them inside there and I seal that up, and I store that at refrigerator temperature. And like, I had Jerusalem artichokes that I had from a year earlier that some of them did begin to rot on the top and all, but a lot of them had sprouts coming out of them by the end of the season when I didn't eat them. So that'd be one way. I guess it depends. Tulips, my wife puts in a brown paper bag and throws them in the crisper, and they last a season that way.
Right. Most tubers are going to last better and store better for you in a cold, dry environment. So potatoes, what I do with potatoes is I put them on bread racks, my seed potatoes, and I put them on a bread rack, and I cover them with lime, and I set them outdoors under a drop shed. They're protected from rain falling on them. But if I cover them with lime like that, I learned this from a 7-year-old gardener that I've learned a lot from, who could grow a tomato in a concrete parking lot. And he did that. He taught me that. And that keeps any rats and squirrels from chewing on them, because they take a bite out of it and they get the lime in their mouth. They say, this is awful. Mice, you know, that's a big problem. Rodents getting into your tubers. So they're stored cold and dry. And he just goes out there, same, me too. When it's time to to harvest to plant the tubers, sorry, and just cut them in half, cut them in quarters. I don't look at how many eyes are there. I don't have time to screw around with that. I just take the potato, I chop it into quarters, and I lay it back on the rack and let it sit there for a few days and let it kind of scab over, and then I plant them. So most of my tuber storage is cold and dry. You can store them in the fridge. I think the Jerusalem artichoke are actually called corms. Don't quote me on that. I'm not positive.
I think you're right.
But you know, those are not technically tubers, and those should not dry out.
No, they don't dry out, but they're crumbs, exactly. And
right.
So, like, water chestnut's the same way. If you dry out water chestnut Jerusalem artichoke, so I guess you have to figure out what you're dealing with.
Right,
because Nick's right, you don't want a wet potato.
Yeah, make sure that you know if you're actually dealing with a tuber or if it is a corm or a root. Some of the things are tuberous looking, but they're not tubers. So I would suggest find out exactly what you're wanting to store and just Google storage
of that thing instead
storage.
Of tuber or chrome, like storage of Jerusalem artichoke, storage
right.
of tulip bulbs, storage of daffodil.
And
you know.
You'll get tons of good information on specific storage requirements for that thing. And that's what I would suggest you do.
All right, cool, man. Thanks for the tips, guys.
No problem.
Rolling along, we are going to go to area code 913. 913, your line should be open.
Yes, I have a wooded area that has the eastern cedar, and if the guy that called earlier that wants some, he can come out and dig all he wants. But my problem is that I have too many of them, and so I want to replant that area with more of a forage tree for my sheep, and I have some mimosa seeds.
Right.
So my question is, since the cedars are kind of allopathic, when I plant the mimosa seeds, should I, you know, plant them a certain way from the stump that I've cut down?
Chop the junipers down, the cedar down, chop it down, set it off to the side, and plant your mimosa all over the place. What comes up will come up and grow just fine for you. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
That
would just plant from seed and plant a lot more than you think you need and call what you need to call. And the ones that can kick the cedar's ass, they're the ones you want. Natural selection at work.
Great. Thank you.
Do you know how to scarify those mimosa seeds?
If you could tell me, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to?
I'll do it because I do it all the time. And well, you do too. So go ahead.
Right. Okay. So you're gonna take your mimosa. I use like a jelly jar or a pint jar normally, and I'll put my mimosa seed in the bottom of the pint jar. And I'll bring some water up to boil, turn the heat off, and let it sit there until it doesn't make any noise. So it's just off of boil, and I fill the pint jar up with almost boiling water, stick a lid on it, and push it off to the side of the counter, and I let it sit there overnight. And then I dump it out on through a little sieve or something like that, and I pick out all of the seeds that are swollen and toss them in some damp vermiculite or some potting soil or some sand or something to take out and plant. And then the rest of them that don't swell up, I put them back in the jar, pour almost boiling water over them again, do that process again. And generally with the mimosa, it just takes one treatment like that, and they're pretty much all done. If almost all of them are swollen up and there's only a handful of them in there, then I won't worry about
it. Throw those away and get some new seeds if you need more.
I just put them all in there. I don't worry about it because they might do fine.
Yeah.
I like when I'm dealing with seed like that's gotten wet, I don't want to dry it out. So it's going to be sticking to my fingers and stuff. I'll mix that with something that's easy to spread, like sand or vermiculite or some really loose potting soil. so that I can take that handful and sprinkle it on my seed bed or sprinkle it directly on the ground where it's going to grow. And then I make sure it's in good contact with the soil, you know, walk over it, tramp it in, and cover it lightly with some mulch and water it in, and you're good to go.
I mean, and the way I do it is almost exactly the same, except when I want to, you know, see what's going to sprout, I take all my freshly scarified seed, I spread it out on a paper towel that's damp, I fold one layer or two layers of paper towel over the top, basically a double layer folded in half with the seeds in the middle. I set that in an open Ziploc bag on a desk so it's going to be warm and germinate. The next day I open it up, everything that's got a little rootlet starting to come out of it goes in the ground. And I just keep doing that until whatever doesn't germinate, I don't plant. But, I mean, I'm being a little more meticulous. Nick's just...
Yeah.
It's up to you how you want to do it.
I say just don't worry about it. The seed is cheap.
It is cheap.
Just, you know, do the hot water scarification process and toss it in something, some medium that's easy to sprinkle out of your hand. Put it in the ground. If they don't grow, who cares? They're in the ground. They're just going to feed some worms.
Yeah, because you're going to have plenty to grow. I mean, if you
drive
across the South, you see the damn things everywhere. They figure it out on their own. So you're giving them about a 90% better chance with scarification than they have on their own.
Right.
And if you've ever read the things that tell you to sand the seeds with an emery board or something like that, you'll kill yourself before you do 1,000 seeds. But you can do 1,000 seeds in 5 minutes with water.
So I mean, just you don't have to dig a little hole to put the seeds in. You're just
nope.
Just kind of tossing them and put something on top of them and letting them go.
This is what I would do. I would get yourself a leaf rake or a stiff-tined rake, whatever will work for the ground that you're going to rake, and I'd rake all the detritus back so you have soil exposed. I'd toss the seed right on the top of the exposed soil and put the mulch back on top of it. That's it. If you don't have any mulch material, then rake up the ground so that you've just disturbed the top inch or two of ground, of soil, toss the seeds down, and use something like a leaf rake to just kind of mix them into the soil, and then just stomp all over the ground to push them in into the soil, and then water it.
If the ground really sucks, carry a 5-gallon bucket full of compost, throw some seeds on the ground, throw a handful of compost on it,
step
on the compost, throw a few leaves on it, and go on with your life.
Yep. Because all you want to do
is make sure
they're in good contact with the soil.
Does the mimosa, does it stand wet feet? I mean, I have an area that stays fairly wet throughout the year. It's not flooded, but it's a kind of a low area.
It's probably not going to appreciate that very much. They'll grow on the ditch sides a lot, but I've never seen them growing
in the
bottom of a ditch where it's often wet.
Okay.
So, you know what?
Okay.
The seed's cheap. Just don't plant all of it in the wet area, but plant some of it, and hey, it might work.
Yeah.
I would look into planting willow down there for your sheep.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll
love
the work.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that as well. One more question, if I can. It's also got a lot of honey locusts down there. Will the shade limit the size of the mimosa? The shade of the honey locust?
It might. It just depends on how much shade there is. You can always go through there with a chainsaw and just chop the tops out of the honey locust and open it up for the mimosa. But it's hard for me to tell. I don't know how much shade there is there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
No problem.
All right. Drop that hand. And we will go on now to area code 704. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. So, Nick, I think you talked about the dram mist heads in the softwood cuttings. Do you have a source for those? I've been having a devil of a time finding them. And then the other thing is the sterile vermiculite that you mentioned for use in those beds. You know, it's sterile when you pour it out, but obviously after the first use, it gets less and less sterile. Do you replace that periodically, or do you just assume that it maintains enough hygiene to not worry about it?
Nope. As soon as I've used it once, it goes into potting soil mix, and it goes into pots. and it's done with its life. Okay. It's served its purpose for starting seed. And
okay, so you're replacing that every cycle.
He's talking about your misting bed.
No, I don't use vermiculite in the mist bed.
Okay, then I think maybe he's...
For the mist sticks, those are really hard to find online. I'm working on getting a wholesaler to send me a shipment of them so that I can actually retail them for people that are wanting to set these systems up. I'll see if I can find a place that'll sell them in one or two or three or four off groups. If I can find that, I will let everyone know either through the TSP with a post on Jack's blog, or most likely through my Facebook page, PermaEthos Facebook page, and I'll add it to the resources on the propagation course.
Just to make sure we've answered the question right, I think when he was asking about vermiculite, he was expecting that you're putting that in the misting bed, and we don't use that. We would use sharp sand or a mixture of sand and perlite. And what the question, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bud, but I think what you were saying is when I've gone through a season of rooting cuttings in a misting bed, do I replace that material or just keep using it? Is that what you were asking?
Yes, correct. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, no. If it's a mist bed, then you're not using vermiculite. Vermiculite would keep things... No, it's not any more expensive than perlite.
Really?
But it would keep it too wet. Vermiculite holds moisture. It's like little tiny sponges. Perlite is like little tiny lava rock. So lava rock is going to drain really well, and the perlite is like the little lava rock. The vermiculite is like little... sponges. It looks like it's flat sheets of mica, and they pop it, and the little bit of moisture in between each of those layers of mica pops open from the steam, and now you have that space in between each sheet of mica that will hold water. It'll suck it up like a sponge. So you don't want to use that for your mist beds because it will be soaking wet. It will rot your cuttings. So do not use that for your mist beds. If you have to increase the drainage because your sand is too fine, then use perlite. And it's white. Vermiculite is a light coppery brown. And as far as the mist bed goes, it's outside. You're not worried about sterile media for your mist bed at all because it's outdoors and it's exposed to the elements. Just keep rooting in it until it fills up with so much dirt that you're kind of potting in your...
Yeah, you basically built soil with it, then it probably would make a good soil amendment or something, and you could redo it. But I think it'd be quite a while before you'd have to do that.
Right.
Gotcha.
And then when you've gotten so much organic material in those mist beds, you pull it out and mix it into your potting mixes. It's great for that. All right, next question.
We're going to move on, and I don't mean to cut you off, but we have quite a few questions, and it's only 15 minutes left in the call, so I have to put Nick on the road. So I'm going to go ahead and call on 573. 573, you should be open.
Yeah, Jack, Nick, this is Scott again. Timing is everything when you're doing cuttings. How do you tell when to do hardwood and softwood cuttings? And the same question with taking scion wood and when to graft.
Okay, hardwood cuttings are after the tree has gone dormant in the fall. So if it's lost all of its leaves, it's dormant, you can take hardwood cuttings, and that's when you need to. Softwood cuttings are in the spring. Generally, it's about 2 months after the new growth has started. So if your new growth starts in March, then in May, they're probably going to be ripening enough to take softwood cuttings. I cover, what those look like and what the indicators are in the course for the softwood cuttings. And as far as grafting goes, you want to take your scion wood. Before your grafting season starts, if you're just keeping your scion wood in the fridge and just regular, vegetable crisper temperatures, then you want to take your scion wood about 2 or 3 weeks, no more than, sorry, 2 or 3 weeks before your grafting season starts, before you're actually going to put them on the rootstock or overgraft them or whatever, because they'll only last, they'll only keep that good viability for a few weeks in the vegetable crisper. What I'm doing with my cyanwood that I'm taking here at Jack's is they're going home with me. They're going to be wrapped up in Ziploc bags, inside a trash bag so they don't get wet. And they're going in the bottom of a cooler, and I'm putting ice on top of them so they'll stay right at 32 degrees. And that cooler is going inside my outside fridge. And what that's going to do is that's going to keep that at 32 degrees inside that little cooler. And I won't have to replace my ice all the time and have a lot of water in there. And that's going to extend the life of my cyanwood for 2 or 3 months. So I can use that cyanwood for 2 or 3 months from this weekend. So that's how you take the cyanwood. I think I pretty well cover the indicators for the hardwood and softwood and the cyanwood in the course. You might want to review that.
And I think with your softwoods, with your misting system, if you think it's time, take some and put them in there. And
right.
If they don't root for you, take some the next week. And I would say that the key to this business, folks, is copious notes.
Yep.
Every single – and not just what week it was, but what everything looked like. I mean, I've had old folks tell me things like, you know when you put your tomatoes in the ground? When? When the blackberries flower. It sounds like ridiculous hokum, but then you do it, and it works, right? So – you might determine there's certain things that nature's doing when it's time for you to take your cuttings from X tree. And so this year it might be the first week of June. Next year it might be the last week of May. The following year it might be the third week of June. So try to remember, you know, what it looked like. Everybody has a cell phone now. Take a picture of it.
Yep.
And if you get great results, you know, and you have that picture of whenever you take a cutting of autumn olive, it looks like this, it roots well. Well, now you know. So some of this you're going to learn as you go.
Yeah, and I would say do it for one growing season. Take cuttings, put them in a mist bed, and try it. I'd be surprised if most people that try this for one growing season aren't very comfortable with knowing what to look for by the second growing season.
Yeah, you'll know it doesn't work.
Yeah. You'll know exactly what it looks like and feels like when it's succulent green growth, and it's too early.
Okay, I'm gonna.
Hey, thanks. I just knew you were taking Scion wood this weekend, and where I am, it's got a quarter inch of ice all over everything.
It's good though.
Yeah,
you're better off than me. We had a lot of stuff that Nick couldn't take because it got too warm too early.
Yeah,
and I have stuff budding out that normally wouldn't be when that tree's completely asleep.
That's right.
That's beautiful.
Yep.
So I'm going to go ahead and take another call because, again, I'm trying to get as many people as I can. I don't mean to push you off the line or anything, sir, but area code 281.
Hey, I'm south of Houston. I've got a pear tree that's native rootstock that they found in downtown Houston, and it's starting to break leaves. Can I cut those water shoots off of there and do a hardwood rooting with those?
Nope. If it's already broken dormancy, you're way, way, way too late for hardwood cuttings. Hardwood cuttings needed to have been taken in the fall as soon as the leaves drop. That's the best time to take hardwood cutting.
Okay.
I would wait until the softwood new growth has grown enough that you can harvest it for softwood cuttings and stick it in a mist bed. You'll probably get more success and get more cuttings off of it if you wait.
Okay, I'm gonna call that one done then, and we're gonna move on. Again, I don't mean to push people off. We're down to 10 minutes, and I want to take as many as I can. So, area code 407. You're about to come off mute.
Yeah, I've got the website for the Dramsticks. It is pro-horticulture.com. You can order one or a bunch. Nick gave that site already. And somewhere.
Okay.
My question, I
thought I found a place and answered it in the questions in the course, but I wasn't positive and I didn't know what it was off the top of my head.
So pro horticulture with a hyphen.
That's one.
Yep. Do you know
pro
with
and
Yeah, just for everyone that's wondering, look through the Q&A portion on the videos on the course, and you should find it there.
Yeah, they've got options from 10-inch up to 36-inch sticks.
Yep.
And you just pick which one you want to go.
And I think the ones that I have are 30-inch.
Oh, good. That's the one I ordered. Okay. My question is, you mentioned earlier you want to know what we want in the advanced course. How do we let you know what we want?
Leave it in the Q&A sections. Just say, suggestion, I'd like to see this in the advanced course. Or I'd like to learn about this.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to roll on. Again, 5-star. We do have some people dropping, so you might get it in. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. Area code 770, you're coming off mute now.
Hi, Jack. This is Nathan in North Georgia again. A quick comment and then a question about tree cones. Comments. We could really use some electronic badges to use on our website or our promotional materials that says things like, you know, PermaEthos PDC certified or PermaEthos plant nursery certified. Is there any chance of getting those kinds of badges for use on our brochures and on our website?
Absolutely, we could do that. If there's a demand for it, if you guys will use it, we're happy to have you guys co-brand with us. So, yes, we could do that.
Great. Tree cones, are they worth it?
Tree cones, the containers?
Yes.
My gut is you can probably grow things just as well in a raised bed with some nice prepared soil, and not have as much invested in hardware in the containers. But if it works for your situation, then they're great.
I've played with them for a year. If I wanted to make little seedling trees and ship them somewhere, I think that they're great for that, because the most expensive component is the rack that holds the containers. I've got really, really deep ones, which I probably spent more money on than I should, because my experience was with starting apples and mimosa and stuff in them, they do really great until the tree gets about 2 to 4 inches tall, and it stops growing. And so at that point, it needs to be going into the ground. So I would personally, after using them, only use them if I was going to be doing lots of transplants and I just wanted my job to be easy, or if I was shipping them somewhere. If I wanted to grow out seedlings for a season, I'd put them in a grow bed with, you know, really, really loose gravel sand mixture type thing, perlite, whatever, and I would design that bed so at the end of the season I could unscrew the boards and pull it out as bare roots. And I think you're going to get much larger seedlings over a season. My experience playing with them has been they're designed to start a seed, get it up to a size, and put it in the ground where it's going to grow.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Let's move on. And I am going to go to 309. 309, you should open any second. There you go.
Hi, Jack and Nick. This is great. My question is, if you're doing a large, broad-scale tree planting, several acres where it's not practical to individually protect the trees, we've had a lot of rabbit damage over the winter, and what's the best way to prevent that in the future?
You're going to want to get some tree tubes. There's lots of different kinds. You can use hardware cloth, but you definitely want to get those tubes or hardware cloth on them as soon as possible to protect them from rabbits. And if you're somewhere that you have snow cover, make sure that you buy tubes or hardware cloth that's going to extend up high enough that it's going to go above any of the highest snowfall that you think you're going to have. Because what'll happen is, they'll scurry right along that surface, and if they come across a fruit tree, they'll girdle it at the snow surface or right below it, and you'll really be upset if you bought tree tubes that were 20 inches tall and you had a 3 foot
of snow, right?
Yeah, 3 foot of snow, then you're going to have girdled trees. So, yeah, I go with tree tubes of some sort.
Okay, thanks.
No problem. All right, we're going to go to the next question. Area code 281. Area code 281.
Yes, I have taken a cutting off of my avocado tree when I chopped it down to protect it from the frost about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I stuck it in a mason jar with some water and some root tone. It's starting to develop the little roots. How long do the roots need to be before I put it in its individual pot to have it really take off?
All right. What I like to see with roots is just as much mass in plant matter in the roots as in the top of the cutting. So if you look at it and you think, okay, if I were to go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do I develop that root mass with just rooting hormone? Do I add anything in there?
Nope.
Do I need to keep the water at a certain level at the mason jar or what?
Just keep those roots covered in water and keep replacing it. I'd say replace it every day. You don't want that to turn stagnant or nasty with bacteria. You want to keep it clean and healthy looking down there. So don't
All right.
fill it up.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, don't fill it up really, really high. Just make sure that all of the roots are covered, that all of the roots are in the water.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem. All right. Anyone else? We have 3 more minutes.
5-star to ask a question.
Yep, 5-star to ask a question. Aha, we got 575. Go ahead, 575.
Hi, yeah, I was wondering, after grafting a fruit tree, should you plant the roots in a misting bed with the Stan perlite mix or in a potting soil?
You're gonna graft onto rootstock that already has roots. And you're just going to plant that like you would a normal plant. So you're not going to take scion wood and graft that onto a piece that needs to be rooted. You're going to graft that onto something that already has roots. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it's not possible to do it on new rootstock then, trying to grow roots off of it plus grafting onto it then.
Nope, it's going to have so much going on there. It's not going to have enough embodied energy in the cuttings to both root and heal over the graft.
Okay, thank you. One more quick question. You were talking about the hoop house. I live in New Mexico. It's real windy and hot. I was going to get the shade cloth on the propagation bed. Is there a percent of light transmission that you would recommend?
Yep, I think I recommend on the course that you use at least 60%. You might want to go with 70% shade cloth, and the way that's listed is it is that amount of shade. So 70% shade cloth is 30% light transmission. That's what I'd suggest.
Okay, great. Thank you. Do you have time for one more? Or?
Well, we've got 5 or 6 more questions, so I'd like to give someone else a chance.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. 978. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I have a question about growing out rootstock. Is the best method for that coppicing, or would you just grow it out to a full tree? I mean, for example, like in apples.
So if I'm trying to grow rootstock, I'll tell you what I'm doing this year in my nursery is I'm taking softwood cuttings of anything that I need to make rootstock from, and I'm sticking them in my intermittent mist system, and I'm going to grow those out. A lot of my rootstock for next year is going to be grown straight from seed. I ordered a whole bunch of seed that I'm going to be growing in seed beds, and I'll let that grow for a year, and next late winter I'll graft directly onto those. So I'd say either do softwood cuttings or grow it from seed. But if you're doing a whole lot, grow it from seed.
And I would also just add to that real quick, don't be afraid to buy rootstocks, especially you guys, if you're learning and practicing your grafting craft, right? Try to reduce your margin of error to one location. So if you've screwed it up, you know what you've screwed up. So if I was going to do a bunch of apples, I'd go, I mean, M111 from Rain Tree, you can buy 25, a bundle of 25 for $1.85 a root. Or you can do Antonovka or M26 or Bud 9 or whatever. They're all about $1 something a root. So maybe, like, if you're going to try to graft an apple or graft a plum or graft a peach, try to grow some of your own, but maybe, like, your first stab at it, buy, like, a professionally prepared rootstock. So you also then, it's kind of like with beekeeping, never have one hive. You have something to compare it to as you be, you know, and then move toward doing more of your own thing. But you'll find a lot of people that sell, you know, apples or plums or peaches or pears that do a ton of grafting. Buy their rootstock so that they reduce the amount of what they're responsible for, because they know when they buy X, it's X every single time.
Great, thanks.
All righty. We're going to go to the next caller, 385.
Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
Howdy. Seeing as it's just about ending and whatnot, I really wanted to say, Jonathan again, thank you guys for this. Seriously, you put on an awesome course through the PDC and through the plant propagation course, and these two call-in things have been fantastic. Wanted to thank you.
Well, thanks, Jonathan.
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to go to 412.
Hi, this is Kurt from Pittsburgh. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Hey, Kurt.
Hey, very quick question. What grade vermiculite do you use? Is it the coarse, fine, medium?
Any of them will work. I use horticultural grade. The most recent stuff I got was kind of fine. It was fine for what I needed it for. I've used the coarse stuff. I'd probably say go with the medium to fine for starting small seeds. You might want to go with the coarse stuff for large seeds.
All right. Perfect. Thanks.
No problem. All right. We're going to go to area code 832.
Yes. Earlier we were talking about how to educate ourselves on identifying trees, weeds, that kind of thing. In the spirit of educating our customers, what can we do to do the same thing about soils so they're successful if they're buying from us?
I would say have some good soil on hand. Learn what it looks like when soil is too dry and when it's too wet. That is the biggest thing that I see people just really stupidly do, is they soak their plants to death. When you grab that soil, a handful of soil, and you squeeze it, and you can squeeze out a quarter cup of water, it's too wet. You're just going to kill them. When you squeeze that soil, when it is perfectly moist, you should be able to squeeze out like maybe a quarter to a half of a teaspoon of water. Maybe. Anything more than that, I think, is too much. So I'd show them what good soil looks like and what well-moistened soil looks like.
And the reality is you're only going to be able to do so much for the biology of your customer's soil, but, you know, mulch goes a long way and compost tea goes a long way. And most of us aren't going to be selling a lot of mulch, but many of us could at least be selling some compost or compost tea to our customers. So if you can get them doing that, if you can get them planting some good gilding plants like comfrey, et cetera, with that, that's another opportunity to sell them something. I mean, if you get somebody, when they put a tree in, to treat it three times a year with compost tea, put mulch around it, and plant a couple comfrey around it,
right?
You're as far as you're going to take most suburbanites until they want to go further, and then they'll tell you what they need to know. The most valuable thing I ever learned in sales was your customers teach you what you need to know. So use a lot of listening skills and get them to tell you what their problems are, and then address their individual problems. And you'll start to figure out really quickly that 90% of your customers have the same problems, and if you educate to those problems, you'll be good to go.
And also make sure that they understand that their soil needs to be covered at all times. The best thing would be, you know, to keep them covered with a mulch of some kind and not grass. I see lots of people that they plant fruit trees in the middle of a yard and then they mow around it. And grass is growing right up to the trunk, and their riding lawnmower is compacting the soil right at the root zone. And it's a four-year-old tree, and they're wondering, why hasn't it grown more than this 2 inches? Well, dude, your soil is hot, it's dry, it's compacted, and
it ain't forest-like.
Right, it's not like a forest. It needs to be loose, cool, and moist, and you only get that when it is mulched.
You know what? That's how I tell your customers to know what good soil looks like. Take a walk in a park, go into the wooded part of the park, take your feet, drag your foot across the leaves, and look down. That's what your dirt should look like at your house.
Yeah.
If you make your dirt look like that, you'll be good to go.
All righty. We're going to go to the next one. We have 913.
Can you use black corrugated pipe as tree protectors?
Yes, you can. It doesn't work as good as the purpose-built tree protectors like the that you can find all over the net. Some people will have problems with mice and voles getting inside there and actually making a nest inside it. And it might keep it a little too moist in there. You want to have ventilation, and you don't want to bake it. So I would say if you have any other option, to go with a different option, because you don't want high humidity in there, and you don't want it to get baked. So if you're anywhere in the South, black is just going to literally
cook
the cambium of that tree. So I'd steer clear of the black corrugated stuff. You can probably spend less money or about the same or just a little bit more on a purpose-designed product.
Okay, thank you. This was free, so I just wanted to see. Thank you.
No problem.
Great course.
Thanks. Okay, 704.
Final one.
For those of us who are interested in getting into this at a more commercial level and are going to be looking at shipping, have you guys found any tricks or tips or things you found worked well? Or, you know, Jack, I know you mentioned on one podcast recently about a gentleman who does only chip budding so that he can ship very small trees. Anything you'd recommend in terms of getting product to people if still in a good quality state?
Well, yeah, he does actually what's called a bench graft, which is a single bud, you know, graft to rootstock, and it ships very well. The problem that there is with that is it requires an educated customer that knows how to basically manage that tree for the first year. But it's really great to sell to educated customers, I can tell you. I'd rather sell to intelligence than ignorance any day. Some other things I would suggest, though, is if let's say you're doing bare root trees. I'd rather sell my bare root trees. I'd rather grow them this year into dormancy and sell them the next year instead of taking care of them for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Yeah, you get more when you sell a bigger caliper tree, but a lot of things happen. It costs more to ship, and it's more likely that your customer will kill it. If you sell a customer a tree that's been grown out for 1 year from seed or grafted 1 year and trained for 1 year on rootstock, it's a small root system. It's a small tree. It's easy to plant. They're probably going to plant it at the right depth. They're also going to probably have reasonable expectations, and the tree is going to have a very healthy root system that whatever pruning you have to do to get it to fit in a shipping box is going to be, you know, a lot easier to do. But I would say one of the things to try to think of right away with, even if you want to be more of a, we'll call it commercial nursery, develop your local market first. I promise you, if you develop your local market first, that you will have a better chance of developing a brand that you can ship all around the country or all around the world. There are so many things you don't have to worry about with a local market. Getting a nurseryman's license is very easy in almost every state. It's not a big deal. You know me, I don't like government, but if you're going to be selling commercially, even locally, you should get one. My state, it's $60 a year. You get that. Anything inside your state, there's no certificates, there's no nothing, there's no problems, there's no mailman to, you know, I just ordered a whole bunch of locusts and autumn olives, and it looked like the mailman kicked it through my fence with his boot. I was surprised that the plants weren't damaged. I got lucky. They were such, but see, why didn't they get damaged? They were small seedlings. So that's why they were not damaged. If that guy had treated a box, I'd let Charlie out to bite him. I swear to God. If it had been, you know, really expensive plantings that were treated that way. So that minimizes it. I would also say that, again, everybody focuses on the trees. But in permaculture, the mass plantings are your shrubs, your perennial herbaceous, and stuff like that. That stuff ships small lots in one package. People can absorb $8 of shipping on $200 worth of plants in their head really, really easy. $8 of shipping on two trees for $10 a tree. They can't get, even though, you know, would I drive a tree to your house three states away for $8? Hell no. They don't think in value that way. So small, anything to be shipped dormant, things that are shipped dormant are going to be less likely to have problems. Those are all the things. Keep it as small as possible. Ship dormant whenever possible. And build the local market first.
Thank you.
All right. I think we're gonna wrap there. Kudos to Nick. Nick's got a long drive ahead of him and not the nicest weather, but he stayed for an extra 10 minutes. So we appreciate you for doing that, Nick. And I appreciate all you guys. And there's a bunch of questions that came in by email that we had come in for people that couldn't attend the call. And we did that in case there was dead space, which there wasn't any. So Nick and I will probably sometime when either one of us finds 5 minutes, call each other on Skype and do it almost like a podcast, all the emailed questions, and we'll put that up as well. Because even those of you that got in, there's probably questions you didn't think to ask, and we'll try to knock those out too. And the MP3s of these two calls should be available by the middle of the coming week. And we appreciate all of you guys for being here today. Thank you very much, and we are going to close up now. Again, thank you guys, and keep plugging along because there's a lot of opportunity there if you really want to make it happen.